We're going to get started here. Good morning and good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jerry Revich from Goldman Sachs, and really excited to have with us John Pfeifer, Chief Operating Officer of Oshkosh, Pat Davidson, Director of Investor Relations. John has a few prepared remarks, and then we'll dive into Q&A. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us.
Great. Delighted to be here. Good morning to everyone here. Good afternoon if you're in time zones that are further east of here. Delighted to talk about the Oshkosh Corporation for a few minutes with everyone today. First slide, obligatory forward-looking statements. I don't need to go into this any further. Oshkosh Corporation, high level, who are we? We've got 15,000 people that are working in 150 sites in nearly two dozen countries. We produce in our latest closed fiscal year $8.4 billion in revenue. That's high level. Today, I want to give you an understanding of what it means to be a different integrated global industrial company, talk a bit about our capital allocation and why we're positioned for long-term success in our markets. High-level stuff on that $8.4 billion in revenue I just mentioned, about 50% of it's access. We group our companies in four segments, access being the biggest. Defense is about a quarter of the business, and then you see fire and emergency and commercial segments that we compete in. You see on the right-hand side of that chart, we are highly weighted towards North America. That's a big opportunity for us. It's a big opportunity. I'll give you three examples as we'll continue to globalize our business. Access equipment in Asia, particularly in China, has hit a critical mass and will go into momentum with accelerating growth rates, big growth rates several years into the future as adoption rates have gone up. In our defense business, our JLTV platform hit full rate production. That means we can start selling it globally. There are 60,000 armored Humvees outside the United States that over the next 10+ years will need to be replaced. That's a huge opportunity for our defense business. Even in our F&E business, where one of the segments we serve is airport products, airport growth is expected to continue to happen over the next at least 15 years, certainly in places like Asia. We're a leader in the products that we serve in airports. That's another global growth opportunity for our business. That's why I show that right-hand pie chart. Let me go into the different integrated global industrial company. We serve a lot of diverse end markets, a lot of different verticals, which don't look like the other verticals that we serve. They're all a little bit different. We have a real capability, and we have a demonstrated capability at Oshkosh to use technology and operating capability across those segments using our scale in technology and even using our scale in operations to be able to serve those segments really, really well. That's what we mean when we say we're a different integrated global industrial primarily. Our culture. We think our culture is a very powerful strength in our company. You see on the left there, in the market in general, 71% of employees are not engaged, 60% of millennials, they say that they don't feel really connected to the business that they're in. That's an advantage for us because we got a really strong sense of purpose at Oshkosh. We know what we're about. We're about we move people at work productively and safely, and that is not a small statement when you talk about a soldier on a battlefield and what we do for that soldier, or you talk about a firefighter and what we do for that firefighter. 15,000 people that work at Oshkosh Corporation, they get it. When they're putting together a JLTV tactical wheeled vehicle, they know what they're doing, and they know where that vehicle's going, and they take pride in it. That is not. I cannot understate how strong of an advantage that is for us as a company when you have 15,000 people that know why we're in business and feel it every single day. We're a recognized leader. We make a big difference for our customers. We get recognized all the time. You see some of the awards there on vehicle achievement and vehicle dynamics or the Bravo Zulu Award, where we get awards from the Navy for being on time and under budget. There's not very many defense contractors that are on time and under budget. I'm sure you can count them on less than the fingers you have on one hand. That's very powerful. We think that we deliver a lot for our shareholders in consistent returns that we've been delivering over time. You can see ethics and compliance and sustainability are big for us as a company. Signposts that I mean what I say. We were just put on the 2019 World's Most Ethical Companies list again for the fifth straight year. That's delivered by Ethisphere. And we're on the Dow Jones Sustainability Indices. That is no small feat for us as a company, a great signpost that we mean what we say when we say we care about sustainability. We are an industry leader in all those verticals where we compete. You can see number one in every single one of these on the page, with the exception of Jourdan, which is number two. We think that's powerful. That's even more powerful when we talk about what our core capability is at Oshkosh. We are an innovation company. We've been an innovation company for 103 years. And 858 active patents, 1,350 engineers, degreed engineers, all the way up to PhDs, that are doing research and are in program development to deploy new innovations to deliver that powerful purpose that I talked about. Where are we focused? Megatrends, electrification, mobility systems, data connectivity and telematics, autonomy. So I want, if you have the opportunity to go to the ConExpo show, you go into McNeilis' booth and check out how the data connectivity is transforming how a fleet operator can drive productivity and how a driver themselves can drive productivity improvement and safety improvement in doing what they do. That's real improvement in our product line. Go into the JLG display and you see innovation everywhere. You see electrification on current product. You see mobility systems where we've got self-leveling chassis, which drive huge gains in productivity for our customers. So these types of innovations in megatrends are what those 1,350 people are doing. That drives margin, that drives power for our customers, that makes us a different integrated global industrial company. Disciplined capital allocation. Real quick on this, I think that you probably know we target to deliver about half of our free cash flow back to our shareholders. Now, we don't promise every single year we're going to do that. Sometimes it's going to be more than 50%, sometimes it'll be a little bit less. Where else does our money go? Those big mega trends. We do a lot of program development, a lot of investment in ourselves to deliver the next innovative solution for our customers. And we know from an inorganic standpoint where it is that we think it's attractive to acquire. We know the segments we're interested in, and we'll be focused on executing there as well with the cash flow that doesn't go back to shareholders to drive growth in our business. We're well positioned for success. We've got attractive end markets that we serve, some good secular tailwinds that we think are long-term in nature. Talked about free cash flow and our integrated approach to cost containment. I didn't get a lot into that, but that has really helped us drive margin gain as well in some of our segments. So those are my introductory comments. And now I'll turn it over to you for questions.
Thanks, John. Obviously, the business is in a much better position today compared to the last industrial recession. Can you talk about key aspects of that stand out to you in terms of your preparation ability to deliver improved margins in this environment compared to the last cycle?
Yeah.
And also, can you talk about the order rates that you're seeing in each of your businesses?
Yeah.
Obviously, it's a fluid situation, but if you give us an update, that'd be great.
Sure. So I think that we are much, much better positioned today for the cycles and the down cycle than we were, say, in 2015. And I think we're on a fiscal year where our first quarter ended December 31st. I think in our first quarter, and that you look at the results of the first quarter, I think that that's a data point that shows that what we're saying is real. Because we saw in our access segment, we saw sales drop about 13%, mm-hmm. but we saw, essentially no drop in our operating income performance. I think that's a data point. So why are we able to do that? We have done an enormous amount of work in operations in terms of simplification of what we do through 80-20 philosophy. That has made us more resilient when either markets increase or demand increases or demand comes down a little bit. That's part of it. And the other part of it is just continuing to drive margin gain through new product innovations. That also helps us quite a bit as well as we go through the downturn. But as we look at order rates, our customer base right now in terms of currently what we're looking at, we've got record backlogs in some of our segments, like F&E. Backlog is healthy at our access segment. It's healthy across all of our segments, really. Our customers are more worried about supply chain interruption because of COVID-19 than they are about their demand that they're seeing in their segments. They're worried, and they talk to us mostly about where do they need to adjust if we've got supply chain interruption.
I think a good example too, John, is the S-Series 2.0, right? Yeah. It's our front discharge concrete mixer, you know, newly introduced here at the show, completely redesigned, and the backlog goes well into the fall, kind of September, October timeframe. The team there is very happy with it, yeah. And it's been a very strong, positive show there.
And in terms of just the real-time update on orders placed at the show, how does that compare versus the last Con Expo? Can you talk about if you're, and appreciate the backlog is strong, but how's the incoming order rate?
So we do get orders at the show, but this is not a big order taking show for us. So we don't measure how many orders did we take 3 years ago versus how many orders are we taking now. Now we take some orders. We took orders for our new electric scissor product yesterday. Truckloads of those getting ordered. But this isn't a big order taking show, so we don't do the comparison. This is a show where we demonstrate what's new today that we've just introduced and what's coming in the near future. And if you go to the McNeilus booth or you go to the JLG booth, you'll see examples of all the new innovative products all throughout the booth. It's a show for us to demonstrate to our customers what's new. It's not necessarily an order-taking show.
And you mentioned customer concern around the supply chain. Can you talk about your visibility on Tier 2 suppliers?
Yeah.
And at the plant level, can you talk about if you've seen a rise in absences in any of your major facilities?
So our the biggest challenge that we had, by the way, we have not had significant interruption in Europe because although they are doing a lot of, let's call it self or mandated quarantine, people are going to work. Mm-hmm. So people are at work every day and they're still producing, and we haven't seen significant disruption with supply chain there. The biggest problem that we had was in China, of course, because China basically shut down. I mean, nobody was working there for 4 to 6 weeks. And when that was the case, we had real difficulty communicating with our supply chain about what our red items, you know, so we track it daily. I get a daily report every day, shows where we have the biggest risk. And we had difficulty in that 4 to 6 week period just communicating with suppliers to know what the status was. Now that China's back up and in production, and we're back in production, we'll be at full production again end of this month and early April. Mm-hmm. We're now back in communication with every single one of our suppliers. So now we know where the real risk is, and we plan with everything from air freight to changing sources. You know, we're a global company. We've got production in a lot of different places. So we sometimes can switch production to a different source if we have to. Sometimes we have to go to air freight. We're able to mitigate the impact of it. We've had small impact, but nothing that's materially impacted our core plants outside of China.
And in terms of the ramp that you described, full production by early April
in China.
Yeah. Is that the same cadence for your major suppliers in China as well?
Correct.
Okay. Rob, please go ahead.
Thanks for the event. Just two questions on China, one following up on your comment short term and one longer term. I don't want to mischaracterize, but it does sound as though production is getting better, not worse in China.
That's right.
You monitor, obviously, employee health. Infections are not coming back as people have come back to work. I mean, is it fair to say that's on an okay glide path?
So we don't have any employees in China that we know of who have been infected with COVID-19.
However, that's true across the company, right?
That's true across the company. We don't have anyone in our company that we know of today, as I sit here, that's been diagnosed with COVID-19. Mm-hmm. Now, what happens in China is, you know, people were away with their families outside of Tianjin, where our main production is, or Shanghai, where we also have operations. And the government requires anybody coming back into their home where they live from outside that district to go into mandatory quarantine, regardless of where they were or who they saw. Yeah. So that's why we can't immediately get back up to production, because it takes a little while till all those people go through quarantine.
Perfect. And then you addressed in your opening comments just the access market in China. And obviously, access has massive safety benefits versus scaffolds and ladders, even in the U.S., and productivity as well, which is mixed in China, I suppose. Can you just give us a sense of that market? How many years does it take to develop? What's the local competition looking like? Will you guys be, you know, champions there? Will it be a dogfight? You know, just a big picture comment on what you think China looks like over the next several years.
So China's going to continue to go through market momentum, where I mean big growth rates year over year for the foreseeable future. And the way that we measure that is the number of, let's say, AWPs, aerial work platforms, per construction worker. And we are still way below what the U.S. is in terms of AWPs per construction worker. And we're still finding in the United States even new applications for aerial work platforms. So that's you see the adoption of it happening, creating, and I'm not talking 20% growth rates. I mean, I'm talking way beyond that in terms of the growth rates that the market's seeing. So now there's tough local competition for sure. We know there's going to be tough local competition. We don't expect to have 50% of the market in China. But we do expect to do what we've done in the U.S., which is be the market leader, be the leader in innovation, be the leader at the top end of the market. That's where we are in China. That's where we want to be in China.
Thank you.
And while the mic's making it over to David, can you talk about your access equipment business from a market share standpoint today compared to 4 years ago? So in 16, the business bottomed at about $3 billion in sales during the oil downturn at the time. Low end of guidance is about $3.5 billion. Anything that we need to keep in mind as we think about the company's market position, the supply dynamics in the market, are other moving pieces as we compare the two cycles?
I mean, we don't give a specific share count, Jerry, and I know you know that, so I'll just give John a little boundary there, but
I'll go so far as to say we're gaining market share, for sure.
And we did, those of you that follow us closely, we did some restructuring back in 17 and 18 telehandlers, right, where we consolidated in both the U.S. and in Europe. So we did take, we did see some share reduction there in telehandlers, and we knew that, and I think we've largely gained most of that back, and I think we're in a very good position, so.
Okay. David, go ahead.
Hi, David Rasso. Would you mind, when you mentioned the supply chain risk, you haven't seen much disruption yet. Would you mind giving some insight on your businesses? Where would the risk be lowest to highest, meaning you already have alternative vendors or sister facilities that can get around the issue, or other areas where you just know it is what it is? It'll be a challenge if that area is going to take a hit and you don't really have alternative sources. And that's beyond, even if you can get around it, there might be higher freight. I'm not talking about just the cost, but literally where there could be a blatant disruption.
So the highest risk that we talk about COVID-19 generated risk, right?
Correct.
Is what
Correct.
I'm primarily Correct. Talking about. By far and away, our biggest risk is in our access segment because we have operations in China, and therefore we've got supply chain in China that doesn't just serve our plants in China. It serves plants that we have in the U.S. and other regions of the world as well, because we use the capability of the supply chain in China to our advantage, of course, as any industrial company does. So that's where the risk is. It's in access. It's with those suppliers in China. We have had some disruption, but nothing we can't mitigate, nothing that's material that's, say, stopped a big production line in the United States or down in León, Mexico or something like that. We've been able to mitigate it through moving the supplier where we can resource to an already qualified supplier. Because remember, we're making highly engineered product. You can't just willy-nilly move suppliers. They have to be qualified suppliers. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if we have another qualified supplier, then it's easy to move the supply chain to mitigate risk. And then a lot of it comes through expedited air freight to make sure that we have what we need to not slow our production. And we've been able to do that relatively well. It hasn't been easy. We have dozens and dozens and dozens of supply chain people that work on it around the clock. But we've been able to mitigate the risk of it so that none of it has been material enough to matter.
And the redundancies of what you make in Europe and North America and China, if Europe might be the next supply chain risk, let's argue, can McConnellsburg and the U.S. facilities make up for most? I mean, you do have longer time on the water to serve it, but can you give us some sense of that overlap where if the European facility took a, you know, a required shutdown or whatever it may be, can you ship from the U.S. or is it just illogical?
We can.
The time it would take to get over there?
No, we could ultimately ship from the U.S. We don't have those plans today. The advantage, again, Europe's not a big risk because people are still going to work. China became a problem when nobody could go to work for 4 to 6 weeks. Europe, they're doing a lot of quarantining and they're, you know, you can't have assembly and things like that, but people are allowed to go to work, so that means supply chains are moving. So we haven't had as big of an issue there. If people can have to stop going to work for a month, it's going to be a problem, and then we may go to, well, we're going to have to ship from McConnellsburg or something like that.
Yeah, I was thinking logistics, where even if they're up and running, trying to get the components around the around the region.
Yeah.
In an area that's less economically sensitive, where I think investors are, you know, trying to find where maybe there's less risk, the JLTV, is there anything from the Army at all that's changing at all the flow of how they're ordering and delivery dates? And second, any conversations with European or Middle Eastern countries about foreign orders that you can give us any update on? And of course, if there's any impact on how they're changing negotiations with other issues at hand for them.
Do you want me to start?
Yeah, it's good to have a defense question.
Yeah, it's good to have a defense question. So we are pleased, continue to be pleased with the orders that we've taken for, let's call it international, mm-hmm. JLTV, and our forecast for what we expect for international orders for JLTV, we remain to be pleased with, and as we've reported in the past.
Mm-hmm. And that's a lot. I'm sorry to jump in, but you know, we've got three firm orders already that we've announced publicly, and there's another group of, you know, kind of 12 to 15 between, you know, primarily NATO allies in Europe as well as Middle East. And you know, there's lots of interest, there's lots of demos, if you will, and you know, one of the largest customers that will be coming, United Kingdom. They were the first to achieve State Department approval a couple of years back, and we talked about, you know, their sort of methodical approach. You know, Brexit certainly figured into that a little bit. You know, they will be a good solid customer, probably one of the bigger volume customers. But we knew they wouldn't be one of the first. It would be, you know, kind of the smaller countries where, you know, again, we've seen Lithuania, Montenegro, right, Slovenia. Those are the first three, but there will be others.
So. Yeah.
And so, again, for looking for non-economically sensitive demand like that, I know Pat likes talking about the JLTV margins in detail. So regarding these international orders already won, and if there's any insight on the other potential 12 that you're looking at, how are the margins internationally versus domestic? Are they, you know, modestly higher, or is it somewhat material, A, just due to the different pricing you'd give the local, you know, military versus foreign, and how they're speccing out those trucks internationally?
If they're FMS, foreign military sales, essentially Same. That's U.S. pricing. So
there's no change in pricing.
They're buying, they're buying off the Department of Defense contract,
yeah.
But they have to buy vehicles that are
U.S. spec.
U.S.
If
spec, yeah. Right? If they want their own spec, then they don't buy on a foreign military mm-hmm. sale. That's when we have better margins.
Okay, so
but you're getting higher pricing or the same pricing at higher volumes, so you get the full absorption benefit in this case.
Potentially, yes.
But any insights on the way they're speccing it? We're just trying to look for areas that are offsetting.
I'm not aware of them speccing it differently.
They're not speccing it differently at the moment.
It doesn't mean they aren't, David. I just don't think we are, and I think it's early. But right now, you know, there's four configurations for JLTV. There will be more. Essentially, that's kind of the palette that both the U.S. and our international customers have to choose from. Two-door configuration, four-door configuration, And those have a little bit difference in margin, not something that's something where we would sort of discern it or comment on it publicly.
And lastly, again, another potential offset. Obviously discussed this with Wilson last week. Your balance sheet, you speak to, you're not looking to add a third leg, so nothing of size. Obviously the market's giving you a big pullback in your stock, and your balance sheet by the end of this year is going to be 0.2, 0.3 of EBITDA. Would you be opportunistic in this market environment to accelerate your share repurchases? And if not, why not?
So we have a 10B, let me, John, jump in, but we have a 10B5-1 in place. And in the way we've structured it, we've done it this way for a number of years. When our share price is higher, the volume of buying is down a little bit. When share price goes down, we've got kind of grades. It does go up a little bit. That's probably the most that we would say. We're not going to update our free cash flow capital allocation here today. So,
but philosophically, why would you not go beyond just the way you gridded it out, saying, sure, if the debt price is down lower, you buy a little higher? But in opportunities like this, the strength of your balance sheet, if you're not looking to do a large acquisition, why would you not use the opportunity today?
Well, I can't tell you what we have planned. Our balance sheet is used to reinvest in our company organically through all the innovation work that we do. Our balance sheet is used to buy back shares, to return money to shareholders, and our balance sheet will be used for acquisitions. And so we need to maintain optionality, especially when we go into a downturn, because when we go into a downturn, there's optionality outside of share repurchases that we need to make sure we're ready for. And so we're maintaining, on average, 50% a year will go back to shareholders.
A lot of free
share
cash
repurchases.
Flow, though, right? That's
so
free cash flow.
As our share price goes down, sure, we try to take advantage of it, but we're still maintaining our primary objective of average of 50% per year back to shareholders.
And sorry to push on this. I'm not talking about use of free cash flow. I'm talking about the use of the balance sheet.
Right.
Wilson's on record for saying 2x net debt to EBITDA is sort of where he thinks the company should run. Now, your EBITDA can get hit financially. I get that. But your EBITDA right now is about $850 million. I mean, just one turn of EBITDA, the balance sheet going to share repo, is a significant part of your market cap. So just philosophically, I don't understand why in a moment like this, unless you think your EBITDA is going to get hit significantly, you wouldn't do at least half a turn of EBITDA towards share repo. And I'm just trying to understand philosophically, what's the value of a great balance sheet if in a moment like this, you still stay very prudent, don't even get close to even one time turn EBITDA on the leverage, and use it in moments like this?
We certainly appreciate your observation as you carried on from at your conference a week or so ago. Same line of questioning. And we do have optionality. And I guess I would say that we've been, a pretty good repurchaser of our shares. And again, to the extent that we talk publicly about it, there's not really an update to provide. We don't disagree that when the shares are cheaper, it's a better investment for us in terms of where it had been. The math says
pretty obvious,
that, right?
Right. Yeah.
But I guess I would also say with John in the company, we always had an always-on philosophy. We've got a sharp guy running our business development, and we do evaluate. We haven't made a large acquisition in a long time, but we do have good opportunities that come across the desk, and we do consider them. And they've got to pass criteria where they fit well, good strategic fit, got to be good value, and it's got to be something that we believe we can integrate well, and that's something that's still out there.
I want to make sure we touch on the margin opportunity point before we run out of time here. Big improvement in your business. How much more juice do you have left in the lemon in terms of getting margins higher? Which businesses is that?
Yep.
And if we do get a downturn, what are some of the things that all of a sudden you could do exiting the potential downturn that would position you better for the next cycle?
So you've seen, for example, in our F&E segment that we've been able to push margins up over time to 15% operating margins. We've done that through two things. We've done that through operations and our simplification strategy. It's paid huge dividends for us in getting to that 15%, but it's also been done through innovation and new products. The Ascendant Aerial platform has been fantastic for us. And it helps us drive market share gains, and it helps us drive better margins for our products. So it's both of those things that have done it. But we're not stopping at 15 in F&E. We still see opportunity to grow our margins at F&E. Now, if you look to our commercial segment, you know, we're a few innings behind where F&E is, so there's bigger runway to grow margins in commercial as we go forward, and we really dig into the simplification activity and coupling that with new product innovation and allowing a fleet of mixer vehicles to operate more productively and drive better total cost of ownership, which helps us drive better margins with the product in terms of how we price it. That's as an example. JLG, operations are really, really solid in JLG. They have a track record for running really good lean operations. And they're in a great spot right now, and their margin drive will be through innovations and new product development as we go forward. But we also have good runway with margin growth at JLG, we believe, due to those two things. That's what I'll say about it.
And in terms of simplification within commercial, how long of a product cycle is that? Is that something that's, you know, we're thinking about that for 22, 23 delivered products, or how quickly can we start to see the products coming in with?
Well, you see the brand new in the McNeilus booth, the brand new S-Series 2.0 front discharge concrete mixer. That's a great example of a new product that's going to help us drive better margins in the business.
Yeah, this year it's delivering now, and it's ramping up through fiscal 20. So,
and is that a big product as a percentage of your concrete placement business? How can you put that in perspective for us?
It's an important product. Yeah.
It's 20% of the concrete mixers. You know, rear discharge is the dominant form in concrete mixers, and front discharge it's kind of 80-20-ish, maybe 85-15 in some areas.
And new product cadence on the waste side, so obviously big gap, and some of that is accounting, but big gap versus Dover's business. What's the timing of potentially narrowing that gap?
Narrowing the gap on?
Margins.
On margins?
From new products and simplification.
What we want to do with regard to our waste business is we want to expand our capability to grow it. So that means we need more capacity to grow that business. As we simplify it, and that's going to allow us to drive better margins in that business, and that's what we're working on right now.
Can you say more? Are your lead times too far, or can you say more about the capacity point?
Lead times are long, and we see the industry continuing to grow going forward.
Okay. Good. With that, please join me in thanking John and Pat for making it out. The gentlemen, thank you for joining us.
Thanks.